Hey everyone, T here. We watch a lot of movies and shows, but not all of them warrant a full episode. Sometimes maybe they're too popular, maybe they're no good, maybe they're not even on Netflix, but are still worth mentioning in passing. So welcome to the first ever episode of One Guy, a Movie, and a Minicast. I recently watched Father of the Year on Netflix. It comes from the year 2018, it has a runtime of 1 hour, 34 minutes, and currently sits at 5.2 out of 10 on IMDb, with a 32 score on Metacritic. It features David Spade with a bad accent, trying to help his son get his dream job at a big faceless tech company, and prove that he can beat up his son's best friend's dad. I'm old enough to have a certain amount of respect and love for David Spade. Maybe it's more nostalgia than anything. But whatever the reason, I thought I'd give this one a go. The trailer and the Netflix synopsis make it out to be more of a story about two friends trying to figure out whose dad can take the other in a fight. But that's really secondary to the actual story. This feels like a very standard 90s movie, harkening back to the glory days of Spade, which, by the way, don't always age incredibly well. It's more about Spade's son trying to get some criminal charges dropped after his dad lands the two of them in jail. Also, about Spade's son trying to get a cute local girl. Also, about Spade's son's best friend trying to figure out what he wants to do with his life. Also, about the friend's dad being paranoid and on the lookout for a crazy David Spade. Also, about a handful of lovable losers that have very little to do with anything. It's full of sight gags, dirty jokes, juvenile humor, and everything else you would expect from David Spade at this point. This feels like it could almost be a retooled third Joe Dirt movie, and that's not a good thing. Like I said, it feels like a movie from the mid to late 90s. There's not much here even for the hardest core of hardcore David Spade fans. In fact, there's nothing even here for teens looking for a raunchy way to spend a Saturday night in their rooms. Unless those teens really want to see a man blowing on David Spade's nipples. Gonna go ahead and throw down a score for this one at a 1 out of 10 for this thing. Well, maybe a 2 out of 10. It is better than Joe Dirt 2, after all. Hey everyone, T here again, for another One Guy, a Movie, and a Minicast. This time I'm here to tell you about War Machine. This movie hails from a simpler time, known as 2017. It has a runtime of 2 hours and 2 minutes. It currently sits at 6 out of 10 on IMDb, and currently holds a 56 rating on Metacritic. While this movie could easily make a full-length episode, I'm choosing to do it as a minicast for a couple of reasons. One, when it landed in 2017, it made a few waves. It was even making waves just by being announced in 2015. This one is just a bit popular for a show all about finding the gems of Netflix. I know, we recently covered Bird Box. A pick that I made and I feel bad about, so call me a hypocrite if you want. I understand. Second, this film is kinda political. Not just kinda political, it's very political. We're not running a politics podcast here. It's still a bit early on in this experiment to potentially alienate half our audience, because our audience is kinda small right now. War Machine stars Brad Pitt, Topher Grace, Anthony Michael Hall, and Ben Kingsley, among others. It also features very brief, and I do mean very brief, cameos from Tilda Swinton and Russell Crowe. It's inspired slash based on a very true book, The Operators, about the very real General Stanley McChrystal. I'm not overly familiar with the source material, so I really can't speak to its accuracy, but some quick online sleuthing will result in learning that this is a fictionalized, satirical telling of the story. Instead of Stanley McChrystal, it's Glenn McMahon. The story of McChrystal was one about a general tasked with winning an impossible war. It resulted in him retiring from duty after a damning article in Rolling Stone was released, detailing outward disrespect for their commander-in-chief, then-President Obama. This film keeps in line with that pretty well, albeit satirically. As I mentioned, Brad Pitt plays General Glenn McMahon, the fictional version of McChrystal. His performance is fine, he's a little over the top, and since I'm not particularly well-versed with the source material, or the real McChrystal for that matter, I'm not sure how exaggerated the character is. One has to imagine, though, that it's pretty exaggerated. He has a clawed hand, runs like a poorly animated 1950s gorilla, constantly stumbles over his words, talks in a strange, over-the-top, growly voice, and has less knowledge of technology than Mr. Magoo. His performance is downright distracting at times, and if that's not the way the real McChrystal is, I'm not sure it helps the film or the character. It has a lovable cast of misfits played by a lovable group of actors, each granted their own little introduction, but overall feel flat. The film sets them up like key players in a heist or scheme that just never really happens. Most of the film is focused on the bureaucracy and red tape that makes war and managing war far more difficult than many realize. It pokes fun at those in charge, and it does it in a fun, clever way with a script that is nothing short of charming. There is a battle sequence toward the end of the movie that manages to be tense overall, but still nice and subdued, keeping away from glorifying or sensationalizing war. Make no mistake, War Machine is an anti-Afghanistan war movie, and it's not particularly friendly with the Obama administration, so it has potential to be polarizing. If you supported the war and liked Obama, which seems like a strange combination to me personally, you're not likely to enjoy this. If you didn't support the war, but liked Obama, you might find yourself at odds with its message as well. If you didn't support the war and didn't like Obama, you might enjoy this a little bit more. Or maybe I'm completely wrong, and regardless of your wartime feelings in the Big O administration, you might just think it's a funny movie. It's impossible to gauge how people will react to this thing, for a million different reasons. It's quick-paced, mildly entertaining, maybe true, maybe not, and potentially respectfully offensive. Later on down the road, once this film slides further into obscurity, we might cover it on a grander scale. But for now, all you get is this little mini-cast. Throwing down a score for this one, I'm calling it a 6 out of 10. It sets out to satirize war and politics, and it does it well. Just not phenomenally. Hey everyone. T here with another one guy, a movie, and a mini-cast. Today, I'm truly mining the cavernous depths of Netflix to bring you a bite-sized review of the Scarlett Johansson arthouse horror flick, Under the Skin. This one comes to us all the way from 2013. It currently has an IMDb rating of 6.3 and a Metacritic score of 78, and that's out of 43 critic reviews. Oh man, where to start? And what to say? This is bizarre, to say the least. I mean, of course it is. It's an art house thing. But still. The story? I'm not sure. The characters? I mean, I guess there are some. Kind of. The film follows Scarlett Johansson as some sort of alien being. She arrives on Earth and takes to the streets of Scotland, picking up men only to lure them to their eventual death. There's a little bit of sexuality in this film. I mean, it does revolve around Scarlett Johansson seducing men, but in all reality, you're not seeing any real seduction. She picks them up, maybe has a slight conversation, and cuts to a strange scene in which she leads them to their doom. There is one kind of sort of sex scene, and I'm not even sure that's an accurate description. And there is an attempted rape scene if you're sensitive to that kind of content. It starts out simple enough, but about three quarters of the way through, Johansson's character takes a strange turn and begins almost a metamorphosis. I'm not sure what the real point of the story is. These types of things tend to be steeped in all kinds of crazy symbolism. Maybe it's a story of what it means to be human. Maybe it's a story of feminism and control over one's life. Maybe it's being soulless and having no real identity. I don't know, and I don't care. And if that makes me a bad critic, well, then so be it. Oh, and there's also a guy on a motorcycle. Not entirely sure what he's doing here, but he's here no less. I've sat through art house films before, and usually I can find at least some kind of redeeming value to them, even if I don't like their message. I'm looking at you, Lars von Trier. Or lack thereof. I'm looking at you, David Lynch. Under the Skin isn't a masterpiece by any means, but it is a very technically sound film. The camera work is great, the audio is phenomenal and detailed, and the music is brilliantly spooky and expertly crafted. Is that enough to warrant watching this? Probably not. I'm throwing down a 2 out of 10 for this thing.
The finale is creepy, and as I mentioned before, the music is superb. But unless you really, really enjoy experimental art house pieces like this, this one is not for you. If you're looking for an hour and a half of sheer unexplained confusion, you're in for a treat. Otherwise, well, you're just going to be confused and probably frustrated by the lack of any kind of resolution or explanation as to what you've just witnessed.
Hey everyone, T here with another One Guy, a Movie, and a Minicast. Today, I'm taking you on a trip. Come with me not only all the way back to 2015, but also to Southeast Asia. Today I'm talking about the Owen Wilson, Lake Bell, Pierce Brosnan actioner, No Escape. This film currently has an IMDb rating of 6.8 out of 10 with roughly 69,000 ratings, and currently holds a dismal 38 on Metacritic with 33 critic reviews. The story is pretty straightforward. An American engineer gets a job heading a water treatment plant and moves his family to the fourth world. I'm not even sure that's a thing, but it's part of Southeast Asia. They find themselves unknowingly landing in the middle of a coup or uprising. It follows this family of four, a husband, a wife, and two young daughters, as they struggle to survive and keep themselves out of harm's way. Pierce Brosnan shows up early on and introduces himself as sort of a man of the world type. He also helps them get to their hotel. If you're looking for a Brosnan-packed action flick, you're looking in the wrong place. He shows up here and there, but is actually only in this film for maybe 20 minutes. And that might be being generous. The focus here is on Owen Wilson's character and his family. You get about 20 minutes of happy family time before it turns ugly. And once it turns ugly, there's really no going back. The first glimpses of violence are blunt and hard to watch. Later on, however, the film decides to take a turn, shielding the viewer from some of the more violent sequences. It's a strange level of restraint that some might think is admirable, and others might think is just plain cowardly. It's entirely up to the viewer. This viewer, however, leans more on the cowardly side of things. The action gets intense, and while many might not call this a horror film, it certainly contains a lot of horror elements. It's almost a zombie movie, just with the zombies being replaced by rebels. Humans are the true monsters. Yeah, that's a cliche, and this film pushes that sentiment really hard. I won't applaud this film for being particularly daring, though there are a few parts that almost push the envelope. I won't applaud it for being original, though people instead of monsters is kind of a nice change of pace. I won't applaud this film for being realistic. There are a few moments towards the end when old PB is almost comically good at what he does. No, not almost. He is comically good at what he does. I also question just how realistic this ending is. I will applaud Owen Wilson as proving he has what it takes to star in a dramatic role. And honestly, I could see him doing some more serious action after this. He does good. This film could easily warrant a full episode, but we've got our plates full at the moment. So this is what you get. I give No Escape a firm 7 out of 10. The intensity of the action outweighs some of the sillier and less believable aspects. If you're looking for action, you found it. Just don't go in expecting to see Wilson kicking ass and taking names. It's not Taken with Owen Wilson. It's all about survival, and most of the violence happens around the characters, not to them. Hey everybody, T here. Welcome to another One Guy, a Movie, and a mini-cast. Before we get into this, I just want to remind you all that we have an awesome 3-month retrospective episode, so if you haven't listened to it, go and check it out. It's okay, I'll wait. Okay, enough of that. Today, I'm talking about the newly released Netflix original, The Highwaymen, starring Woody Harrelson and Kevin Costner. The story is pretty simple. Two aging former Texas Rangers are enlisted to track down and bring to justice the notorious Bonnie and Clyde. Let's get something important out of the way. This is not a film about Bonnie and Clyde. Don't go in expecting to see much of their infamous and murderous crime spree. In fact, the two only make brief, and I do mean brief, cameos from time to time. I'm a pretty big fan of Woody Harrelson, and I kind of like Costner as well. So when I saw the two of them teaming up for this, I immediately took notice. Unfortunately, both actors fall a little flat. You can blame it on them, or you can blame it on the script.
It doesn't feel like they have much to work with here. It's a lot of driving and small, forgettable conversations between the two of them. Each is granted a monologue to showcase their talents, but they don't seem to be truly in the moment, which is surprising from such established actors. Costner gives an Oscar Beatty speech about how a person's life can take a drastically different turn in the blink of an eye. Harrelson treats the on-screen audience and off-screen viewer to a bloody tale of his early career. Again, these moments seem to fall flat, or worse, feel forced and shoehorned into the film. The camera work is great, and the 1930s aesthetic is wonderfully crafted, all while being paired with a musical score of the same high caliber. I give this film a 6 out of 10. There's so much to love about this film, so why don't I love it so much? It feels like a strange cross between No Country for Old Men and Hell or High Water, only not as interesting or entertaining as either. The lackluster performances and the meandering go-nowhere script really bog this down. It's clear these characters have depth. It's just a shame that we don't get to see any of it.
Hey everybody, T here, with another one guy, a movie, and a mini-cast. Today I'm talking about the brand new Netflix original, Unicorn Store. This is labeled a Netflix film, and was released on the service earlier this month. That's April of 2019 if you're listening to this later, but has a release year listed as 2017 on IMDb. This film currently sits at a 5.4 out of 10 on IMDb, with just over 6,000 ratings. It currently holds a 44 on Metacritic, with 16 reviews, and has a runtime of 1 hour and 32 minutes. It stars Brie Larson, Sam Jackson, Joan Cusack, Bradley Whitford, Mamadou Othi, sorry if I botched that name, and Hamish Linklater. Again, sorry if I botched that name as well. As always, there's more to the cast, and you can find all those people listed on IMDb if you're that interested. The story here is deceptively straightforward. A young woman finds herself at a crossroads when she fails out of art school. Not really sure what to do with her life, not really sure how to be a functioning part of society, not even really sure how to be an adult, she finds herself taking a temp job at an ad agency. It's not long after she embarks on a career as a temp that she's presented with a strange invitation to a mysterious store where she meets Sam Jackson as the salesman. He offers to let her adopt a unicorn, a lifelong dream, if she can meet very specific requirements. The story from here on out turns into Brie Larson's character Kit attempting to prove herself responsible, not only to the salesman, but to everyone else around her. Especially her touchy-feely camp counselor parents and their protege, an overachieving childhood friend of Kit's. As I said, it's deceptively straightforward. On the outside, it's a young woman trying to adopt a unicorn. But dig just a little bit deeper, and it's about life, love, and accomplishing your dreams, all while building bridges and mending fences with those closest to you. Unicorn Store has a lot of heart. It's quirky, it's funny, it's well-written, and while I'm not sure I would categorize it as a family movie, it's certainly one that you can watch with the whole family. I give this film a pleasant 8 out of 10. It's fun and worth coming back to from time to time. Brie Larson is lovable and dedicated. She gives a heartfelt performance here, even if she seems like she's doing a young Amy Poehler impression. While this may not be the greatest thing Sam Jackson has ever done, he definitely leaves you wanting more. Honestly, after seeing this, I would love to see him leading a tour through a fanciful chocolate factory. I could go on for days about the rest of this cast as well, but as we know, this is one guy, a movie, and a mini cast, and time is short. Just know, there are no weak links in this cast list. Everyone is great. Thanks for listening. And if you haven't checked the 3-month retrospective episode, it comes right before Henry Poole Is Here, which comes right before Pretty in Pink. Go ahead and give it a listen. It's a great way to get caught up on the show without having to venture into our back catalog, and get to know us at the same time. So with that, I'll see you later.
Hey everyone, T here, for another one guy, a movie, and a mini-cast. Today I'm talking about Salt and Fire. This film features Michael Shannon and stars Veronica Ferris, and comes all the way from 2016. It has a runtime of 1 hour and 38 minutes, but feels like a solid 2+, despite nothing of interest actually happening. I'm going to be handing out some pretty harsh truths here,
along with potential spoilers. Don't worry, though. If you decide to watch this, being spoiled is the least of your problems. The story is simple, though it tries to be complex and thought-provoking. I'm just going to go ahead and read you a couple of IMDb synopsises because, well, why not? A scientist blames the head of a large company for an ecological disaster in South America, but when a volcano begins to show signs of erupting, they must unite to avoid a disaster. If that one wasn't descriptive enough, how about this one? Salt and Fire is about a mysterious hostage-taking, where the leader of a small scientific delegation is deliberately stranded with two blind boys in an area of gigantic salt flats. Shot in Bolivia, the film stars Michael Shannon, Veronica Ferris, and Gael Garcia Bernal, and was written and directed by Werner Herzog. With that out of the way, let's get on with it. Do you want the good or the bad first? Obviously, that's a rhetorical question because, well, I can't hear you. Let's go ahead and start with the bad. This film is horrendously acted. What the hell is Michael Shannon thinking these days? He's such an incredible actor. Why on earth did he do this? Is he in severe debt? I would happily set up a GoFundMe campaign to help him if that's the case. I can only assume the same for Veronica Ferris, who spends a good portion of the film talking into an iPad that apparently has the world's longest battery life. As is often the case, I make the argument that maybe it's not the actor's fault for the bad acting, but instead the script and the direction, or I suppose lack thereof. The dialogue throughout sounds like it was written in German, translated to Spanish, and translated to English, only to be translated back to German and once again back to English. Okay, that's a bit much. But it does sound like a poor translation of sorts. When Michael Shannon says,
"I'm sorry. What a clumsy fool I am.
I find your treatment of my colleagues and me clumsy."
"Accepted, but for that I shall not apologize. I've given up part of myself, but not that."
And Veronica Ferris says,
"I can hear something. Very distant, like a faint rumbling. The salt plain obviously behaves like a gigantic membrane. Are we sitting on a fire that is moving beneath us?"
And when this weirdo says things like,
"I only use a wheelchair when I'm tired of life."
And,
"This is the ideal landing spot for aliens. Nothing on the planet is so totally flat and so vast. Even our satellites use it to calibrate their distance from the ground."
It's easy to say maybe they were victims of poor writing, after all. All is not lost here, however. There is a little redeeming value to it. The camera work and the cinematography are top-notch and first-class. There is no denying this film is beautifully shot. This would work wonderfully as a gallery of still-life photographs. It's just unfortunate that that's not the case. I give this film, if you want to call it that, a dismal, nearly unwatchable 1 out of 10. Here's a fun game to play. Get a group of friends together. Put this on. Mute the volume. Each person, take an actor, and together, voice the characters with whatever nonsense you want. I guarantee you, you will have more fun that way than you ever will by watching it as it was intended. Don't forget to record it either, because those are memories you'll cherish forever.
Hey everyone, T here, with another one guy, a movie, and a mini-cast. Actually, today, it's not a movie. It's the Netflix docuseries, The Disappearance of Madeleine McCann. If you're like me and you kinda dig the true crime genre, this is for you. This story is tragic, frustrating, intriguingly mind-boggling, and terrifying. And all for various reasons at that. The story is that of a small child, the series' namesake, Madeleine McCann, and her disappearance. The creators of the series walk you through the events of the night she disappeared, multiple times, and the insane spiderweb of events that followed. It's all told with a sleek style that draws you in immediately, and it will keep you on the edge of your seat for all 8 parts, guaranteed. If you're anything like me, you will draw conclusions of your own within the first episode or two, only to have those conclusions turned upside down and shaken up. One way or another, you will certainly form your own opinions on the case. Whether you think you know the answers to the mystery, blame the parents for any myriad of reasons, blame the police in Portugal, or even blame the media for misinformation and wild speculation. As a father of one child not much older than Madeleine,
and a child not much younger, this story, and countless others like it, terrify me to my absolute core, and I don't know if that's good or bad. I give this series a 7 out of 10. I'm not the fastest reader in the world. Sometimes the subtitles go a little too fast for me to read, and oftentimes share the screen with the names and labels of those talking. That being said, most of the series is in English, so don't worry too much. This isn't my favorite docuseries on the service. But if you're a fan of Making a Murderer or The Staircase, you will more than likely find something of interest here. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you next time.
Hey everyone, T here with another one guy, a movie, and a minicast. Today, let's make it a double. I'm going to knock down the house with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and together, maybe we can learn just a little bit about MIT. These are two political documentaries, one about a For the People Democrat, and one about a robotic, out-of-touch Republican. But have no fear, we won't be getting too political here. I'm not running a politics podcast here, but it doesn't mean that I can't discuss what works and doesn't work in a film. Let's take a look at these two films, discuss them, and appreciate them, or not, for what they bring to the table as films and documentaries. Before we go any further, though, I would like to say that I am speaking solely on my own behalf. My views are my own. They do not necessarily reflect those of my co-host, Mac. In fact, I know absolutely nothing about him politically. That being said, I do tend to lean a little left and a little liberal. I will do my best to keep my personal political views away from this podcast. Let's begin with Knock Down the House. This Netflix original from 2019 focuses on the primary campaigns of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Amy Villela, Cori Bush, and Paula Jean Swearengin. They claim it focuses on these four, but the real focus is AOC, with a small smattering of the others. What were their names again? Oh right, it doesn't matter. They're losers. And they're not as young or attractive as AOC. If that point of view is narrow and too cynical for your liking, you might as well turn me off right now. Maybe I'm just a jaded cynic. Maybe I'm wrong in my thinking and my criticisms. But you know what? As a voter, it doesn't matter what I'm wrong about. Because voters are customers, and the customer is always right. There are no wrong opinions in politics. Only popular and unpopular. This is a workhorse of a documentary that simply preaches to the choir, and won't be changing anyone's perceptions or preconceived notions anytime soon. It feels like a long political ad. The cynic in me says that every word spoken in this film, is carefully crafted and spoken solely for the cameras. There's even a moment in which Cortez is criticizing her opponent's mailer and comparing it to her own. Amid the criticism, she looks straight at the camera as if to silently say, "Are you effing kidding me?" The cynical viewer will also assume that, like the dialogue, every shot is carefully crafted as well. How many times do we need to see AOC looking humble and solemn as she stares out the window of her apartment, hotel room, or moving car? All these criticisms go for everyone else featured as well, whoever they are. One thing this film has going for it, however, is it gives the world an interesting insight into how politics work and how grassroots machines function, something that is genuinely interesting. I give Knock Down the House a hawkish 2 out of 10. Like I said, it's preaching to the choir. Even as someone with more liberal tendencies, I'm not a part of that choir. It feels disingenuous. It feels like nothing but impersonal political talk, and worst of all, it makes its central heroine, the everywoman, the every person, come off as more of a political robot than an actual human being. I assume the filmmakers feel the same way, since it ends with a strangely forced "look how fun we can be" moment of Ocasio and her partner riding scooters in front of the Capitol. There is an audience for this, and they will get something out of it. It just won't be anything life-changing because they're already in line with it. I'm going to go ahead and take a quick break, but I'll be right back with a review of MIT. Okay, so now you've heard me complain about the leftist documentary Knock Down the House about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and some other people. I figured I should balance this thing out and take a step to the right with the Netflix original MIT. This film comes from 2014. And documents the most intimate moments of the 2012 presidential campaign of Mr. Mitt Romney. Again, a reminder,
My views are my own and do not necessarily reflect those of my co-host Mac. This film is less about politics and more about people. It not only paints a stunningly humble portrait of Mitt Romney, but it proves that politics aren't everything. This film is as much a portrait of Romney's family as it is anything else. It opens with him in a room surrounded by loved ones writing a concession speech, before moving not into the campaign, but instead to a heartwarming home video of the family sledding. Forget that there's a good chance this wealthy robot man and his family are probably sledding somewhere nicer than you and I will ever sled in our lives. It's a touching moment, and at its heart, it's honestly relatable. I've had many similar moments myself. There are a few moments that come off as possibly forced or pandering to the camera, but the film for the most part doesn't feel like it's posturing, and it actually feels, you know, real. Unlike Knock Down the House, this look at the political machine is personal. When it's all said and done, you might find yourself asking if all presidential campaigns are like this. Certainly the answer has to be no. Right? I mean, right? I give this film a strangely warm and accepting 7 out of 10. I know we all live in our bubbles with our own personal bias. We all think we know the truth. We all think we have a complete picture. But the simple fact is, we don't. I'm not going to get conspiratorial here, but the truth is, so much of what I thought about Romney was fed to me in the joking monologues of The Daily Show and The Colbert Report. This film is an eye-opening look at just how the media spins everything political for its own filthy needs. Whether you're watching Fox News, Tommy Loren, reading Trump's Twitter feed, or watching Hasan Minhaj, Trevor Noah, or John Oliver, you will never get a clear picture of someone, Democrat or Republican. Well, maybe reading Trump's Twitter feed will give you a clear picture of him. Whether that's good or bad, though, is entirely up to the reader. The point is, Mitt is a strangely endearing look at a man, a father, and a man of strong faith, all before a politician. This film did something unexpected. It actually made me feel kind of bad for his loss. I mean, I still wouldn't have voted for him in 2012, but if we could have seen this side of him back then, it might have made voting for Gary Johnson seem a little more silly. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you next time.